Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
And we are brought to you by a fine supporter of this fine radio station. The Donald on a Kitchen show is supported by Farm to Folk, an Ames-based food cooperative connecting you to local farmers all year round, including organic meats and produce. More information at farmtofolk.com. Donald on a Kitchen comes to you at noon on Tuesday and repeat at 7 o'clock Tuesday evening if you just can't get enough of this fine program. We are coming to you from KHOI Community Radio. So there, this is the Donald on a Kitchen. We get together once a week to talk about what's on people's plates.
Our favorite topic.
Yeah. So what's going on in your kitchen? The kitchen is a place where the farm meets the plate, and we all love to eat. Since we learned to cook with fire, we've used tools to manipulate and manage our food. Sticks, knives, pots and pans, zesters and whisks, soup spoons and souffle pans, and Cuisinarts. Today, we will consider favorite kitchen gadgets. We have a special guest in our studio today.
Yes, we have with us Marg with the hard G. Mm-hmm. Marg Junkin, who is the owner of Cook's Emporium. I have to say, when I moved to Ames about 9 years ago and I saw we had our own local cooking equipment, et cetera, mm-hmm. store, I went, okay, I know I can live in this place. So thank you, Marg. Has owned Cook's Emporium since 1979, actually a very revolutionary time in the cooking store field. It was kind of the Williams-Sonoma was first emerging, and how did you happen to start a cooking store at that early time in a town this size?
Well, I started at that point in time. I was teaching classes in the adult ed program at Ames High, and cooking classes, that is.
So,
and I taught French cooking, there were a lot of things that you could use that were not available in Ames, but, you know, like quiche. It looks much nicer made in a quiche dish, but you can make it in a pie pan, or you can make it in a Pyrex casserole if that's all you have on hand. But it doesn't look the same, and people wanted things like that. I wasn't sure that there was enough population base in Ames at that time to support a store of that type, but obviously there was. So, and we also draw for our customers on the wide band of the surrounding countryside, too, and mm-hmm. adjoining communities, because you do have to have a certain amount of people to support that a specialized store like that.
So you're kind of our very own Ames's Julia Child here.
Well, people have made that comparison now many times over the years, and Julia was a real pioneer.
Boy, I'll say.
And her life took her to the right place at the right time. It was what you might call one of those fortuitous things. You
right.
could say that happened to me because I was in Ames, Iowa. Just
how did you learn your French cooking? From Julia?
Well, we had lived in Brussels, which is basically a French culture town, even though it's Belgian. And I went to several different French cooking classes over there. I was very much interested in French cooking before that. And, you know, I read all the cookbooks and television, watched all the television shows on cooking. There weren't very many then. In fact,
no,
they were
Julia
almost non-existent.
Julia was just about all.
She was it. Mm-hmm. But she did teach an awful lot of people an awful lot of things,
absolutely.
Like my son, when he called me when I was at work one day and said he wanted to make chocolate mousse, and I said, okay, but there's some techniques I'm not sure you know, and I tried to go through it, and I came to the folding part, and I said, and then you have to fold the egg whites into this mixture, and, oh, I know how to fold, Mom. I watched Julia Child.
Well, a well-educated young man,
well-educated young man, yes.
Plus, they sort of do that. I noticed my son, I thought he couldn't cook at all. And when he went off to college, all of a sudden, he could cook everything because I wasn't there to cook for him. But
that's right.
He'd absorbed it.
He'd watched you, and he probably watched the Food Channel because kids love watching the Food Channel.
It was a little bit before that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He just from mm-hmm. well. Also, if you feed your kids good food, they develop that necessity to maintain that taste. You know,
they do. They certainly do. True. They want good food. Then they go off and they don't get it, and they suddenly decide
they have to make it themselves.
That's right.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're asked you into the Down and Line the Kitchen today to talk about all the tools, all the gadgets that we all have our favorites. What's your definition of a kitchen gadget, Marg?
Well, a kitchen gadget is basically it's a device that usually has a very specific purpose. Now, a knife I would consider a tool. Every kitchen needs a really, really good knife. There is no excuse for not having one. And because you do an awful lot of things with it, there's a lot of things that you can do that there are gadgets for, but you don't necessarily want a kitchen full of gadgets that have a very limited purpose. But like, for example, we're coming up on cherry tree season, and people are starting to ask if we have cherry pitters because...
And I bet... Oh, I know you do. I bought one there.
Yes, except we're out because they're on back order.
Oh, no. Well, everybody's wanting their cherry pitters.
That's right. I've got that problem. I've got to find another company that can ship.
So what do you consider the best cherry pitter? I've seen more contraptions that say they pit cherries. And so describe what a successful gadget for pitting cherries looks like.
One that does the job well, quickly and easily.
And they're all messy.
Oh, all right.
Well, cherries are naturally messy because they are. If they weren't messy, they wouldn't taste as good.
Well, there are several. Like, I started out with the kind that pits cherries and olives, the one at a time, okay?
Yeah.
That I had years ago. It beats putting the paper clip through them one at a time.
Much better than the paper clip.
Although that does work.
Paper clip will work.
I started collecting some from auctions, the old kind, where you kind of... clamp it to the table. It has a little thing, and you run it through. And some are better than others. And then from you, I bought this thing that's like a plastic box.
Oh, okay.
That kind. Was it German? What is it? I can't remember.
But it could be German.
It has a little thing, and you just pump it. It's the least messy.
Yes, because it has the plastic box.
Yeah, is that the one that you're trying to get? Or what do you recommend?
Well, it's a lot of it is personal preference and mm-hmm. how many you're going to do. I personally still like that little hand one, but I have an older one that is well designed and well made, and it lines up with the cherry. There's some on the market now that are not as...
Is this the box kind or the crank kind?
This is the hand kind.
Oh.
Yeah, but the box kind, a lot of people like it because it like you say, it's much less messy. The box keeps the juice from mm-hmm. spurting all over.
Well, also, if you have a tree, you're going to be doing a lot of them.
That's right.
That's
either that or you're going to be giving them away to your neighbors.
Well, or
yeah,
I like to put them in brandy where you don't have to pit them.
That's true. You don't. Yes, if you do that, you don't have to pit them. Yes.
Another trick I found for cherry, I've used an old hand crank kind that works really good, except you have to keep adjusting. By the time you're done with the cherries, you have finally figured out how to adjust it. Then it works fine.
That's right. A cherry, because the pit's in the middle, and then you've got the stem coming out.
It's really tricky.
And you do have to get it lined up exactly right.
Just
or you
right.
mutilate the cherry, and then you end up with some of the pits getting by.
Yeah. But I've learned to do such semi-messy things out on my deck. So the juice just flies all over, but then I just hose down the deck. Instead of juicing up my kitchen,
sure.
I put that messy stuff on.
Yeah, I always put on some old T-shirt or something like that to do it. And it goes in the laundry when I'm done, and I take a shower.
I love cherries so much that it...
Oh, they're so good.
I hate wasting any part of it. You know, it's like, there goes 25% of the juice all over the table. And, they are totally precious.
Ah, cherries. Let's get back to knives. I think Donna and Mark both have opinions on knives.
I am emphatic that anybody who's cooking more than 30 seconds a day should invest in a really good knife. And we're talking,
definitely.
What kind do you have, Wusthof?
We carry Wusthof. which is an expensive knife. But right. if you buy one and take care of it when you're 20, you will still yeah. have it when you're, you know, pretty
yeah.
old,
yeah.
It, like 90.
If you people look at them and go, oh, but a knife is like, oh, $100. Because you
yeah.
want it.
Yes.
We're not talking paring knives. We're talking about a... Even a
well,
six,
you do need a good paring knife, too.
Right, but they're...
A chopping knife.
They're not
knife,
as expensive. But a chef's knife, which yeah. is, a, you know, you can chop, you can dice, and
yeah.
it's... I actually have gotten into the more of the, what are they, 6-inch blades, 8-inch blades?
An 8-inch is a standard chef's knife.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
but a lot of people like a 6, especially women, because their hands are smaller.
Well, and as I've gotten mm-hmm. older, I've used the 6-inch more than the 8-inch.
Plus, you're cooking less, probably, because you mentioned your son. He's moved away.
Oh, well, but I still do a lot of professional cooking.
Oh,
but
okay.
It probably has to do more with the wrist, the worn-out wrist here. But anyway, whichever size, and you can go into Cook's yeah. Emporium, and you can handle it and figure out which one
mm-hmm.
you want.
That's right.
But I think everybody should have at least one good knife. And so mm-hmm. you spend $100, more
roughly,
or less.
Yeah, more or less.
But they really, it's something you'll have for life. And
yeah.
once you start cooking with a good knife, you'll never know how you used even a $20 knife or something.
Oh, yeah.
Because it makes your cooking so much faster, so much easier. And then professional chefs get into a whole thing about, you have a knife kit, right? Which is probably
well, they're doing a lot of different things too.
Yeah. Well, I have one that I travel with, and it's a, you know, so special little bag, and you keep all kind of essential tools in it, and
yes.
multiple knives, and the big boys, people show up and their kit is like, oh,
yeah.
you know, it's really pretentious and over the top, but
right.
it is important. And another thing that I bought from Mark are the little plastic covers that you slide over the blades.
Oh, yes. If you don't have a knife block, those are great.
Yeah.
Or
I have a magnetic strip on the wall for my knives,
well,
which
too.
I really,
mm-hmm.
really love. But when I travel with my knives, so those mm-hmm. plastic covers are really, really...
Oh, yes. They'd be great for
yeah.
that.
So... Now, there's an old French superstition that you cannot give a knife for a gift. It's bad luck.
Right.
So when I give a knife, I always say, you have to buy this knife from me. Give me a nickel. So they pay me for it.
Yes, that superstition is. Most people don't know what the superstition is, but they don't like to give knives for gifts. They will give a set of knives, or they will give, say, a set of steak knives.
Yes,
but
yes.
they will not give a knife.
What is it, a violence thing or a death wish thing? Or
I don't know. There's something about, I heard someone once say, they feel that if you give a knife, it cuts the friendship.
Oh,
exactly.
Okay.
That kind of superstition.
Yeah. And so at one point in time, Wusthof even was packaging a bright, shiny penny with the knife, and you were supposed to, the recipient was supposed to take the penny and use it to give
exactly.
back to the person in payment.
Yes.
But nobody knew what to do with it. And so, as a result, we just don't sell knives. We sell gift certificates, and they say, oh, well, then they can come in and get the knife they want.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, really.
That's
yeah.
the way most people do it?
Well
okay.
If they want to give something like that.
Okay.
Or sometimes they see things like that on, say, a bridal registry, or they know that the couple wants good knives.
Uh-huh.
And they'll say, well, you know, I don't know which one they want and yeah. things. And so I'll just let them pick it up.
Well,
it makes sense because a knife is. In fact, I kind of hate to sell a knife as a gift, because the person using the knife should really feel it and try it and make sure that that's the knife that feels right for them. The weight, the feel of the handle, the bolster, which is that thick part at the end of the blade,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and things like that. Is it comfortable to them? Because mm-hmm. what feels good to my hand may not be what feels good to your hand, and people's hands are different sizes.
I totally agree. And I have an mm-hmm. assortment of them, too, because it kind of depends on what you're cutting. But one
yes.
good knife is, if you pick the right one, is really an essential. And if you don't own one, make yourself a gift.
You can
yes.
do that. I find it really interesting. It's kind of nice that we have this caution or this superstition. There's a magic, or there's something we have to take care of in knives, and this idea mm-hmm. of making it very personal.
Well, they are very personal.
Personal.
And
yeah.
also the sharpness of it. Like, Since I'm a professional chef, everybody is a maniac about keeping their knives really sharp.
Yes.
I don't keep my knife quite as sharp as everyone else.
Oh.
Well, because I know exactly my own level of inaccuracy and clumsiness. And I probably would have lost a few fingers. I keep it just under sharp enough because so that when I hit my hand, for example, I mean, of course, I've cut myself a million times, but probably a million less times because I don't quite keep it as sharp as
other people. Sharp knife is a much less dangerous tool than a dull knife because a dull knife doesn't do the job.
Right, but there's
So you're pushing with it, trying to get it go through whatever you're cutting, and then finally it slips, and then that's when you cut yourself.
Well, but there is a degree of sharpness.
No,
too.
I know people that have that philosophy.
Yeah, I keep it just under probably most people's professional standards.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of feel some people show off with
because
the sharpness.
If you're pushing with the knife, it's not doing the job.
Right,
you are doing the
it's
work.
It's the feel that you're looking for. I know how sharp it is and
like
how sharp I want it. Well,
because the knife will just glide through. You won't have to push.
Right, but I also know it would glide right through my finger. So I'm
pull your fingers back.
I do, but you know I don't keep it that dull.
Yeah, okay.
But I, you know, I notice after I've had my knives freshly sharpened, I'm often like,
okay.
A little bit.
So, yeah. Mark, do you have a way of sharpening, or is it there's a sharpening stone or a sharpening gadget that is good
for
people?
Your preference? You do a lot of sharpening at the store.
We do sharpening because people do not feel comfortable sharpening their own knives. They perceive it as a skill that they are deficient.
Yeah,
and they're afraid to do it.
I have a flat stone that
A flat stone works really, really well, but you kind of have to learn how to use it.
Well, I've tried all of those other mechanical things, and I think the flat stone is the best for me anyway.
It does. You can get the best edge with it.
Yeah.
But there are other sharpeners that work well. There is electric sharpeners now on the market that work very, very well. And, in fact, that's what we use is a very good quality electric sharpener when we sharpen knives for people. Because to use a stone would take forever.
Yeah.
So sometimes they bring in knives that are very difficult to sharpen because they weren't really meant to be sharpened. Like a stainless steel
And you
knife.
Still sharpen those.
Well, we still sharpen those, yes.
You try. Good.
We try.
What about serrated knives? I do love serrated knives, but do you just have to throw them away when they get too dull?
Pretty much. They don't get dull very easily because they work on the principle of having the little points that go down through things, and they're designed for things like breads, pastries.
I wore out my Wusthof bread knife, I have to say.
Yeah, you can wear out a serrated knife. It takes a long time, but it's possible. And they have specific purposes. They're primarily a bread knife, and they also are useful for tomatoes. Anything
Absolutely.
That has a tough outer layer, like
and
bread
a soft
with a crust.
Inner layer.
And a soft inner layer, right. Like a tomato has the skin to get through, and then the inside is soft. That is good tomatoes. There's some that are kind of...
Yeah.
So we've kind of evolved into these wonderfully designed and stainless steel and wonderful blades, but people started out with probably flints and rocks and...
Oh, yes.
And knives used to rust and be not so good before, but we had to use something, so yeah.
That's right, because the knife that you can get the best edge on is a carbon steel knife, and those rust if you don't take care of them. I mean, you should.
And they are not expensive. I used them for years and years.
Everybody did.
But they are a pain in the, you know what, to keep from rusting. A lot of maintenance.
Yes, you have to immediately wash the knife and dry it after you've used it and put it away.
Oh, I wonder if you mentioned a different kind, a ceramic knife or something.
Oh,
or
those
ceramic
knives. Those are kind of new.
Yes,
what is
those
that?
Are new.
What?
And they are actually made out of a fired ceramic material. The main problem is that you have to store them very carefully because
they can break.
Oh.
But they're really good for, like, I have a ceramic paring knife, which I love for fruit, like apples.
They would work great for that.
And I also have a ceramic peeler, which I use on certain
things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, speaking of peelers, I brought two of my favorite gadgets, and they're two peelers. I have two peelers in front of me, or a pair or a peeler. I don't know what they're called. One.
And oh, yes. This is an OXO peeler.
Yeah.
Well, OXO was the real revolution.
Yep.
Peelers themselves, like that one, what we think of as a normal potato peeler with the blade and the handle on it like that, didn't come along until sometime in the 40s, I believe. Late 40s, probably. And
would they use, before that, just paring knives?
They use paring knives. Yeah, that's why the term paring knife. Nobody pares with or peels. And the word pair and peel pretty much mean the same thing. It means to take the peeling or outer covering off of something. Everyone used just a plain small knife, like about a 3-inch knife. And that's why it's called a pair, because that's what it was only used for. And then the peeler came along, and it's so much easier because you don't have to judge how thick the peeling is. It just adjusts to that.
And you can go really fast with them.
You can go really fast, yes.
I brought two peelers because there's certain things that I peel one way and certain things that I peel other ways. I know you can peel towards you with a regular blade on a stick, but I tend to use that for carrots and down, pushing away from me. I have one that I kind of grew up with, and these little things are hard to find. It is a pointed thing that fits in your hand, sort of looks like a triangle, and it has a blade that I take in my hand and pull the peeler toward me, especially for fruit. I can go around an apple really quickly. I like this thing. I can't remember the name of it. It starts with an O, an Otis, an Oxen, or something like that. It's not OXO. Because this little, actually, it looks like a pretty cheapy little thing, and eventually it oxidizes and rusts out. I tended to find them at going out of business hardware stores is where I tended to find them.
Yeah.
Or in
auctions. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, two other little handy things. It has a small grating surface to do a quick grate of a lemon if you need it real quick, and it ends up right in your hand. And it also has this interesting pointed end that I could see my mom going through potatoes with this thing really fast.
And
use a pointed end to dip out the eyes. You can use a pointed end to also dip out the end of an apple, top and bottom, and then go around. This thing, I don't know, maybe it's what you grew up with. So there's
it is a lot of it is what you grew up with.
Tools that I just cherish.
Yeah. How it fits your hand. And thank goodness how long have these soft grip handles been around? They're a really nice invention.
Isn't this what OXO is known for? The
OXO
ergonomic
was the company that invented the soft grip handle. The soft grip handle.
Wide was handle. It's really easy to hold.
Much better than that metal handle that it cuts into your hand if you're doing very much and is very uncomfortable to use. No, it was invented by a man who retired from his regular job, and therefore he was hanging around the house and driving his wife nuts. And he saw her peeling with this thing, and he looked at it, and he says, well, this is the most
uncomfortable,
ungodly, horrible tool. And so he sat down, and he came up with the handle that was comfortable and the blade that would work well. And OXO Company was founded. And now, of course,
there's a whole line of them, right?
It's a huge company. They have a whole design. I don't know if you'd call it a studio or it's a whole building, really. New York City, I think, someplace. And there are people that sit around and they design various kitchen and household tools that are usually things that people have in their homes as a normal.
Yeah, they design them for
comfort and ease of use and practicality and durability. And it is one of the best brands on the market. We sell loads and loads of OXO tools, gadgets.
What are some of the other ones? I can't think right now because the peeler is the main one that I use.
Oh, all kinds.
They do what else with big handles? OXO?
Everything.
pizza cutters.
Yeah, they have pizza cutters. They have cores, like if you want to core an apple. They have so-called rubber spatulas, in other words, scraping spatulas with a big handle.
Mm-hmm.
But other companies have a lot of comfortable handles now, too, because, of course, you know, people, other companies saw the success of it and the practicality
and
of it.
Absolutely.
And that everybody loves it.
Well,
it makes sense. And, in fact, the American Arthritis Association, if that's the correct name, came out endorsing the OXO peeler when it was first on the market.
Ah, making comfy things for our kitchens.
That's right.
You're listening to KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. The Dynalana Kitchen brings you tasty radio here every week. We're going to go to a little tune here. And what could be more appropriate here than a tune called Kitchen Girl? The Dynalana Kitchen. That was a little tune, an old fiddle tune called Kitchen Girl. And that was played by Dan Holloway on cello, Sam Worley on guitar. That's kind of a classic tune. Matter of fact, when people kind of want a basic Appalachian old-time American tune, they go to Kitchen Girl. And when we want to go talk about kitchens today, we're going to talk to Marge Duncan, because she knows a lot about stuff. We're talking about kitchen gadgets here. All of these, the things that we cook with now, have a history to them. You have an interesting book there, Marg. You want to talk about that?
Yes, I found this in Ames Library just last Sunday when I was there. And it's called Fabulous Feast, and it's been around for quite a while. I looked at the copyright when I first purchased. It was in their gift shop area that they call Literary Grounds, so I could buy the book and actually keep it rather than having to take it back in 3 weeks. And it was originally published in 1976. And I don't recall hearing about it then, but I may have. And it's been updated a little bit because this copy is copyright 1989. But it is medieval cookery and ceremony. And there's a lot about the cooking. And one thing I'll quote right here, it says, requirements of the hearth signal a major difference between medieval and modern kitchen gear. You know, flints for fire lighting, bellows for aerating, and iron pot rest. Pot hooks and pot hangers, tongs, and fire tenders were standard equipment.
Yeah.
Well, unless you're grilling out Which is, of course...
Couldn't live without those things then.
Which you may want one or two of those things. Those were standard things. And if you've ever gone to a historical castle or something like that when you've been traveling, and seen a kitchen, it is usually very interesting.
Or even Williamsburg has old colonial kitchens.
Places like Williamsburg
with the walk-in. I mean, the fireplace is as tall as a person.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And there was no electricity in those days. And so cooking
really did have to be very much kill it and eat it. It had to be a very tooth and claw sort of way of cooking.
The production and preparation of food occupied more people because of the time that it took. And people had servants, and you needed servants.
Yes.
There were no food processors. There were no blenders, nothing of that type. And so, therefore, you had servants to haul in the firewood, start the fire, get the water boiling, and things like that. And then over here...
This is, of course, for the upper classes.
Well, the peasants kind of ate what was left over. They didn't fare so well, I don't think.
Yeah.
Yes. And then it shows other pictures in here of things. There were other things. It says three kitchen utensils critical to the preparation of most medieval foods were the mortar, the sieve, and the strainer. And before we start,
which we still use.
Which we still use. We still use sieves and strainers of some sort, and even mortars and pestles. We sell quite a few of those.
Mm-hmm.
People use them to crush various spices, and they have other uses too. We sell one that is quite small. We sell a lot of it. And one day I asked a woman buying it, I says, oh, are you going to crush, you know, something like peppercorns or something for this? Oh, no, I use it to crush my pills.
Oh, of course.
So that I can take them more easily.
That's a good idea, see? So, we all need kitchen gadgets. That's
we all need kitchen gadgets.
Yes,
you know, I've sold kitchen gadgets for all sorts of purposes. You know, occasionally we'll have someone from the university that's working on a project, and they need something for something totally removed from the kitchen and food and eating, and they find a kitchen gadget that will take care of the problem.
What? Wouldn't you know it?
Yeah.
That's good.
So it's kind of fun.
Well, I think the thing that has probably changed American, well, and probably European kitchens the most, though, is the food processor.
Yes. It has been another revolution.
It's kind of the end product or the current evolution of the mortar and pestle. It's a way to chop and mesh.
Yes.
So how long a food processor... things been around? I mean, electric food, but not servant food processors.
Yeah, there definitely is a big difference there. Yes, they've been around probably since the early 70s in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in France before that. The original food processor was invented in France to cope with all of the various things that they use for French cooking.
Well, but before food processors in France, they used the mill.
They used the moulin mill.
They used food mills a lot in Europe, much more than Americans did.
Yes, they did.
It's a hand-cranked thing that presses
It's a food mill, yeah.
Although, you know, my favorite tool that I still have from my mother is, she used to call it a ricer, but it's a conical...
Yes.
On a stand with the wooden...
Works great for making things like applesauce and tomato
absolutely.
Sauce.
Absolutely. And yeah. I use it actually a lot for jams and jellies. Well, not jellies, but jams.
Jams, yes. It works very well for that.
Yep. That has the...
And we still sell a food mill. In fact, the one we carry is made by OXO.
Not to promote them, but they do make a good quality product.
That
still has the wooden tamper in it, or is there a different thing?
Now they're a metal tamper. You can still buy the metal or the wooden tampers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
No, they're still available. There are companies you can get them from.
Well, that's good to know, because I'm always, if I see one at a garage sale or something, I just
snap it up.
I'm afraid they're not going to be there anymore.
No, we don't stock them because we don't have enough demand for them. But, yeah, they do make them.
If you need one, you need one.
It's one of the tools I could not live without.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that, besides having staff in medieval times and before, I was surprised to read that refrigeration for food for food holding and food preserving was a relatively new thing, but
relative to the grand scheme of things, 150 years.
However, people have been eating ice cream and sorbets and icy drinks for thousands of years. I heard, I read in an interesting book that in India, in 300 A.D., there was references to, of course, now this was for the royal court, of eating mango slushy sort of things and sorbets and that sort of things to bring the ice down from the mountains. Or even they had figured out the application of salt to water and to cool the temperatures. Amazing. And in Europe, people had ice creams and slushies and things. I was reading about this, and I mentioned this book before on the radio here, and I'll just mention it again because the history of food, how we eat, it's called Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat by B. Wilson. And that's an interesting thing to think about. Ice cream.
Well, I'm still always fascinated because this predated me a little bit, but how we used to have ice houses and cut the ice from the lake and store it all summer long in
sawdust.
Yeah.
That was
amazing.
Yeah, and sawdust apparently is a very good insulator. Yeah. I remember that from when I was quite young. There was a place near our home north of the town we lived in that was kind of a small lake. And they would cut ice every winter.
Did you grow up in Iowa?
I grew up in Illinois.
Oh, okay. So, me too.
Just very near Iowa.
But you still got to see ice cutting? I can't imagine what it must have been.
Well, my memory of it is very, very vague.
Yeah.
Because I was pretty young.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something I saw every day. So, you know, I can't remember why we went up there because to my parents it was a fairly normal thing. And then in the summer, why the iceman would come around and bring big blocks of ice. And you had a card that you put in your window. And it had the various weights. You could buy 25 pounds, 50 pounds. I suppose you could buy more, but I think those were the normal amounts. And that way the iceman would see how much you needed. And, of course, it would vary on the weather.
So was this a weekly route?
I think it was more like every other day.
Oh! Yeah, wouldn't
last
that
long.
It
would have to be much more than weekly.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah. And deliver ice to people for their ice boxes. And, of course, we got electric refrigerators, and people thought they were much more efficient, which they are, and much better. And
not so messy.
Not nearly so messy, because one of the jobs for the children of the family was to empty the tray in which the melted ice, the water, accumulated. And, of course, if you forgot, it ran over, and Mother got very mad at you because she had to then mop this mess up. And why didn't you empty the...
One of those kitchen chores.
One of those kitchen chores.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's another kitchen tool that we're going to talk about. There must be 152 different garlic things that people have invented. What is your favorite, Marg? What is the latest? Talk us about garlic preparation.
Well, most recipes say to... they use the word press the garlic, which refers to the garlic press, or finely mince the garlic, or finely chop the garlic, all of which mean pretty much the same thing. And, yes, you can chop it up with a knife, but a garlic press makes it much faster.
And it also gives it a different – it's mushier and wetter.
Yes, it is mushier and wetter. And so if you want to sauté it and have it stay in the little pieces, why you don't want to use that.
Right, then you got to hand chop it.
But most of the time, you really want the garlic in fairly very small pieces so that it disperses throughout
like
whatever
soups
food.
And sauces.
Yes,
and,
you want it to flavor the whole dish. You don't want to taste a piece of it, like you might want to taste a piece of carrot or something in your soup. And so the garlic press was invented to take care of that problem. And they do work very well.
Is that a French invention?
I think
the first
it was
ones
Italian.
I saw. Oh, yeah,
I'm
could
not
be.
I'm not sure I'd have to look it up. I can't remember it. I can't remember exactly when they came along. Mm-hmm. And
I find just smashing garlic, a garlic clove with the side of a good chef's knife is probably my favorite way to do it. But I know there's
you can do that.
Right. I know there's ways to peel and rock and roll the garlic. There's so many different garlic things.
Well, my favorite gadget of the moment is a little. It's almost like a mezzaluna. You rock it back and forth, but it has kind of sharpened holes in the middle. Mm-hmm. And now that with the arthritis in my thumb, using a press and squeezing it is not
as difficult for a lot of people that don't have a lot of hand strength.
Yeah, because I want big garlic, right? So the bigger the garlic, the harder it is to squeeze it. So this little mezzaluna, and do you sell them at the store?
Yes, we do sell those.
Oh, goody.
When people come in and say, hey, I'm having a problem. I can't squeeze my garlic press anymore. Is there any other way to do it? I say, yes, you just press, you know.
Yeah, you just rock it back and forth.
Rock it back and forth on a cutting board or whatever.
What do you call that thing? The rocking back and forth thing? What do you call it?
I can't remember what the company calls it exactly, but I call it garlic rocker.
Garlic.
Oh. Something like that. The other thing that I like to do is, like when Lana harvests her garlic and there's lots and lots of it.
Oh, yeah.
Then I put it all in the Cuisinart with olive oil and really make a smoosh out of it. And then I put it in small containers and freeze it. Because here's the thing about garlic. If you buy it that way, like at the grocery store, in the refrigerator department, once you can peel the garlic, but once you actually start smashing the clove, it releases its volatile oils.
Yes.
And its integrity is broken, and it degrades into a not very nice product. So I never recommend people buy already crushed garlic. You can buy the whole cloves peeled if you really must. But you can also peel the cloves and freeze the cloves whole. You know,
because
local garlic has, you can store it for up, 6 months maximum before
in the freezer? Oh, sure.
No. For fresh. Like harvest happens, when do you find it starts getting the little green?
When spring shows up, it knows. I don't know how it knows, but it knows, and it starts growing. So along about March, along about April.
Yeah, I seem to always run out of garlic.
I know I do too,
fresh garlic somewhere
about the middle of February, right?
Yes, exactly. So if I don't have any frozen until the next harvest, which is what, July, August,
July 4th around here.
Having some frozen in the freezer is really good.
Well, and it's a time saver, too, because doing it all at once, getting it over and done with, dealing with the mess, and then you just scoop it out.
It's true. And
But you put it with oil because the oil helps preserve it.
Yeah.
It holds the volatile oils.
And except when I freeze whole cloves. I just freeze them in baggies.
Yes, those you can
freeze. That works really well. But I do find if I've got a little jug of it in the refrigerator that I've processed myself, I tend to use more garlic, which I think deepens the flavor a lot.
Deepens the flavor, and garlic is considered a very healthy.
Yes, it's better than 10 grandmothers or something they used to say.
Oh, at least.
No, I haven't heard that one, but yes, probably.
You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen webpage, KHOIFM.org, and find us there. There are recipes. There are past shows you can download and listen to. And if you have desire to contact us, you can reach us through Gmail, khoiradio@gmail.com. Let's play a little waltz here. This is Waltz de la Petite Jeune Fille, Waltz of the Little Girls. Thank you. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Yes, and today our guest is Marg Junkum from Cook's Emporium right here in Ames. It's located at 313 Main Street. And I think Marg is a kind of one of our local treasures. She knows a lot about what she's doing.
Thank you. That's a real compliment.
Well, we are very lucky to have our own well-established cooking store with especially owned and operated by somebody with the expertise that you have.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate having you here.
No, it's a lot of fun.
I say so.
Good.
We've been talking about kitchen gadgets, things that make our life easier. And during the discussion, I heard the term baggies. What in the world did we do without plastic? Good heavens, people must have had, well, actually, maybe before all the ways of storing Tupperware and covers and all. Maybe people just ate everything right away. I don't know.
Well, there were lots of glass containers.
Oh, okay.
Glass.
You know, of course, the quart bottles and the, you know, all the canning equipment. And then, like, you'll see in yard sales occasionally the glass containers that were made for refrigerators. In fact, I have kind of gone back to glass. And you probably sell the newer glass containers, don't you?
Some, yes. Because people are going back to using glass.
Well, yeah, because we've now find
that. Especially for liquids like water.
Yeah. And some plastics that we have been using, we have found kind of migrate into the food. And
yes, I don't carry anything like that.
Yeah, some of them change the taste, which is the main reason I don't use it. But also some of them have been found to have, what is it, BPA in them?
BPA, yeah.
And stuff that's... So you don't have anything with BPA in your store? Excellent.
No.
Excellent to know.
No. If there's any question, you know, when I'm talking to a manufacturer relative to ordering their product, you know, usually they put that right out there, right up front, you know, that their products contain
no BPA.
And so, you know, I already know it, but I will not knowingly order anything that has any of those.
Well, and what about, I don't really consider silicone a plastic. It is its own.
Technically, it is a plastic in the chemical sense or the manufacturing sense, but most people don't think of it that way because they think of plastic as kind of cheap, breakable, not very good quality.
Right, and silicone has this flexy feeling. And
silicone is another thing that came out of the research and development that was carried on during World War II. And at first, of course, it had military applications. It was researched as a substitute for rubber, because rubber was in very short supply then because it came from South America. And so they were looking for all sorts of rubber substitutes, and it didn't really come along until after the war when people kept working on this stuff.
Well, silicone is in some ways better. I mean, like I used to have rubber spatulas, which would eventually kind of crumble and flake off and get funky. Now
I
have silicone spatulas, which I love.
Unless the dog gets it and bites it, why, it lasts forever.
Exactly. Now, the other thing I use, is a sort of professional trick that's now good for home bakers, is I use a Silpat.
That is also a silicone sheet.
Mm-hmm.
It's reinforced, and it is totally nonstick. No,
and
silicone has two really fantastic properties relative to kitchen things. The high heat factor, in that you can make it so that you can put it in a pan. You can put it in a pan of boiling fat, like if you're frying, and it does not melt.
Nothing happens to
Nothing happens to it, no. And then the other thing is that it's very flexible. It also takes color very well because kitchen items now are all bright and cheerful. White, when I first started in business, things came in white. And then they came in white again, and then they were white. And then all of a sudden, things started coming in color. People love it. It's refreshing and it's bright and makes the kitchen a more fun place.
Well, I'm afraid my okay, a Silpat is a It's a you use it for a cookie sheet liner for a stamp. It's nonstick.
Yes.
Like if I'm cooking sweet potatoes, if I'm baking them, which notoriously ooze out this sticky stuff and then you have to scrub the pan. I just take my half sheet pan, put my Silpat on it, throw the potatoes on it in the oven, and then all of the stuff that comes out, the caramelization, that you're not using.
Rinses right off of it.
Yep. It's so easy to, people will I have to line my baking sheet with this, that, or the other. But if you have a Silpat, that's really all you need.
Yes. If you're using a lot of baking parchment, a Silpat is a cheaper way in the long run to go because you reuse it.
They are kind of expensive. It's kind of like a knife.
But that's why I say if you're doing very much of that.
Right. But my mother, who used to bake, complained that her cookie sheets were all sticking. So I bought her a Silpat. Now, this was 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
She was shocked at the price. However, I still have them and I'm using them.
Yes, that's right.
So, you know,
unless
they're well worth
them.
It.
Why, they last forever.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm so glad that technology is being used
for
some important things, like what we do every day in our kitchens.
Right.
Great. We've been talking to Mark Junkin. She's the owner and purveyor and person of great knowledge at Cook's Emporium. And thank you for being on the air today. Sharing
that's in downtown Main Street.
Yes,
right.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You'll have to come on again. We just scratched the surface of this, of all the things we can do in the kitchen. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. With a tune from the Barn Owl Band, you've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with special guest Mark Junkin from the Cook's Emporium. We've heard music by Dan Holloway and Sam Wormley. They played The Kitchen Girl. And we've had some other great tunes by the local band, the Barn Owl Band. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering, as usual, by Rick Morrison. Support this fine radio station. This is community radio for the heart of Iowa. Eat good food and do enjoy life.